out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Friday, the 4th of May, 2018, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at Radio Arian, and I'm very pleased to welcome back my co-host, who I haven't seen for a couple of weeks, from Mysterium Fasces, Florin Geyer. Florin, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing just grand today. I'm very pleased to be back on the podcast, and most happily, right after I finish, I'm going to go to my last exam. So it's a double celebration, we could say.
Oh, that is good news. That is good news, because we haven't really got very good news to be going through today. What we've got some polls and we've got some statistics, some rather shocking statistics to begin with. And these are national statistics. They were collected in the January 2017 school census in Great Britain. And what they reveal is really horrifying. And this is white British children in British primary schools. So that's age 5 years of age up to 10 years of age. And these are the percentages of white British children in these schools. Slough, 16%. Birmingham, 31%. Bradford, 47%. Luton, that's where Tommy Robinson is from, 21%. Reading, 44%. Manchester, 37%. Coventry, 49%. Nottingham, 46%. Leicester, 29%. London, 26%. Blackburn, 47%. Bedford, 49%. Sandwell, 43%. Wolverhampton, 46%. I mean, this is really shocking, and it shows that it's not just in the south of England with the areas around London like Slough and Luton. It's in the Midlands, in Birmingham and Bradford, and it's also in the north with places like Nottingham. I mean, this is really horrifying when you think about it. If you look at Slough, that's less than a fifth of the school children are white. That means when they are adult, which is, well, you could say in 10 years' time, just in a decade, that all the adults there, it's going to be four-fifths non-white with young adults. And the young whites that are going to be around at that time, they're going to be in a really, really awkward position. They are going to be bullied. They're going to be attacked. They're just going to be bred out unless they suddenly start nurturing a healthy awareness of their race. They're going to end up interbreeding with these non-whites, and they're just going to get blended out if they can't afford to actually leave the area. And this is white genocide. There is no other term for this. This is the replacement of whites out of their, being pushed out of their ancestral homelands. This is our children being displaced. I mean, it must be really horrific for the poor kids that are actually in these schools at the moment. They must be getting bullied all to hell. I mean, we hear that young white working class lads are the most neglected ethnicity group and are the group which is doing the worst in the school league tables. And this is why, because they haven't got any other whites around them. All these programs and all the money and the drive that comes from the government is to raise ethnic minorities' exam results and get them into jobs, and the whites don't get anything at all. And on top of that, they are now outnumbered in these schools. This is horrific. I don't know what it's like in Canada, Florian, but you must have had quite a shock when you saw this, I would have thought.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite a shock. In many urban areas in Canada, it's not much better at all. I went to a high school where whites were a minority, but still a plurality of students. So I'm certainly aware of I know what it's like to come up in these kind of environments, and it's not good. But I mean, even here, it's a little bit more mixed up and heterogeneous than I think it is in some of these places in the United Kingdom. I mean, there's not a lot to say. I mean, as you pointed out, I mean, it's straight genocide. And I think that there's a couple of different things here. When I was leaving Turkey just recently, I was in the Ataturk airport, and I happened to get into a conversation with a young Turkish dude, and he was asking about, we were talking about politics and so on, and he was asking about the situation in Canada, you know, and I told him that, you know, in Canada and the United Kingdom, whites are going to be a minority. And this Turk was like shocked. You can see on his face, he'd never heard or considered such a possibility before. And so the great evil into our own intense shame is that, you know, foreign races, Turks, are more shocked and appalled at such a reality and such a prospect than many of our own people are, who have come to, they've either are ignorant of the reality, or they've just come to accept it as the inevitable terminal of history. And then England, the United Kingdom, has perhaps reached the pinnacle of this. There's no nation in the world that I can think of which is more shockingly depressing because of its general apathy to its own displacement as the United Kingdom, which grieves me immensely. I mean, as much as we might make jokes about the eternal Anglo, it is certainly, you know, from a Canadian perspective, our ancestral homeland and the source of our traditions and our national origin and ethnogenesis. And so it's the great inevitable terminal of this, I mean, is what I see, the great tragedy, is that it's going to be bloody conflict for the next, who knows, 50, 60, 100 years or so. Because this is what has happened in every other instance in European history when there has been a demographic advance of the Islamic world, is that it's taken hundreds of years in order to reclaim and to displace the lands that have been conquered, right, to reconquer them once again for the indigenous peoples, and to kind of re-Christianize and restore and rebalance the rightful property of our indigenous and ancestral homelands. And so I think that these areas where the youth is going to be 75% non-white, you know, I think that we've set ourselves up for only a future of bloody conflict, unfortunately.
It's like we are heaping hot rocks on the foreheads of the future generation by doing this and by doing nothing about it now. And you make a good point there about the Reconquista and how long it took to try and get our lands back. But it's not as bad as if it was. It was worse rather than just apathy, because we're being told we should be celebrating diversity. We've got people that are celebrating this, that think that it's just wonderful that the borders are open and that white people are being replaced in these cities. I mean, the only good point I could say about this, because there really isn't very much, is that it's not the whole of England that's like this. In the rural areas, it is still white. There's a primary school near me, and it's 100% white. And that can't be the only primary school in Great Britain. There's got to be more primary schools like that and more villages like that and areas that are still white. But eventually it's going to make its way out from these city centres. The city centres are just going to be no-go zones. We already have these no-go zones that are people with Muslims that the police won't go into. But these multicultural cities are just going to become no-go zones. People aren't going to want to get acid in the face or stabbings. I mean, we're hearing in London at the moment, more murders took place in London last month than took place in New York. And we're now the acid attack capital of the world. All of this is down to the replacement of our own native white people with non-whites. Now I've got some other news stories here which talk about what we have to come in store from this by replacing our people with brown people. And the first one of these is from Holland, and it says that since 2014 only 15% of the refugees have found work. So that's in 4 years, only 15% of refugees in Holland have found work. They were permitted to work in the Netherlands in 2014, and yet 85% are not in employment. And experts predict that the proportion who do have jobs will rise only to 40% over the next 10 years. Data from the Central Bureau for Statistics revealed the vast majority of refugees have remained unemployed and living off welfare in the 2.5 years since they were granted work permits. Of the 15% who are in employment, the majority of whom are Syrians and Eritreans, according to The Telegraph, most of the refugees who found jobs are only working part-time. Dutch immigration researcher Jan van der Beek said that the number of people granted asylum in the Netherlands who enter the job market will increase, but only to a limited extent. Having analysed the participation in the jobs market of asylum seekers who arrived in the Netherlands between 1999 and 2005, he predicted that the proportion of refugees in work would rise to around 40% in a decade's time. Last week, van der Beek warned that the Dutch welfare state will collapse unless the nation closes its borders to migrants from the Third World, each of whom, on average, costs the state €120,000 over their lifetime. So what we can extrapolate from that is that if we've already got places like Slough that are four-fifths non-white, only 15% of those non-whites are going to even be employed. 85% of them are going to be claiming benefits if they're anything like these refugees. And don't forget that these refugees are given all the encouragement there is to find work. The state will find work for them. It will encourage employers to give them jobs. It will give them grants to take on these refugees. And yet still only 15% of them are in work. And this basically it shows that it's going to be the white man that is paying for all of these non-whites that are replacing the people in Britain and replacing the people in Holland. And we're told that these refugees are rocket scientists and doctors and nurses, and yet most of them can't even read and write, especially these Syrian ones. And it's these Syrian ones that have actually managed to get work, it says here. I remember reading a report a while back that said that they weren't even educated to secondary school standards. They were just educated to the end of primary school. So the fact that they're low IQ, but they haven't even been given a basic education. They're just going to be a drain. They are just a drain on society wherever they are. 15%. That's all that have got work. What do you think of this one, Florian?
No, it's most of the listeners to this program will not be very surprised to hear these statistics, I dare say. But I mean, it confirms with, you know, with demographic data what we've been claiming the whole time. And I think that the this was understood when these social engineering programs began. The people who drafted these open border policies, the people who progressively have promoted an agenda of demographic replacement, they understood the realities of the demographics that they were importing. They knew that they were low skill, low education, low IQ from a very tribal and aggressive society, and that they would not in any means integrate with the culture that they were entering into. This is the idea. The purpose of injecting these people is it's as a parasite, but I would say more as a solvent. It's like a mercury for the purpose of dissolving, you could say almost in an alchemical fashion, dissolving and reducing the host nations that they're injected into this degenerated, formless mass, so that people become, you know, totally cosmopolitanized and deracinated, and they lose their identity. And once those traditional markers of loyalty have been broken down, you know, they become, you know, these non-human, these non-person, you know, economic automatons who exist just to participate in this Babylonian, you know, global economic system. This is the idea. This is the purpose. But what we've seen is that as we've discussed previously on this program and in other places, that the nature of sinfulness and chaos and things that are against the natural order is that they're not sustainable. It's like a house of cards, or it's like a body that's rotted with parasites. You know, injecting a body full of illness and parasites destroys and degenerates the body. And eventually it collapses or it dies. And so what they've done is they've set up, you know, the economy, the social sphere, social capital, all of this just to collapse, to be destroyed, degenerating into chaos. Because when there's no more bread and circuses, when the welfare state can't placate the passions and desires of these invaders with money and whatever else they're after, cocaine and fast cars and blonde women, they're just going to become – they're going to revert back to the mean, which is essentially, tribal violence centered around religion. Islam will be the dominant religious vitalizer in these communities.
That's all that can happen, really, isn't it? It can just lead to violence. I think there's a good analogy there that it's like a solvent. It just breaks everything down into just a brown mess, which is all that there's going to be left of us if we don't start fighting back. Now, I've found another report, and this is actually from 2017, and it says just one in five UK Muslims are in work, and the report blames racism for this. Just one in five adult Muslims are in work. Yeah, according to the UK's Social Mobility Commission. They also found that only 6% of the Muslim population are in professional jobs. The report blamed Islamophobia and racism for the failure of British Muslims to progress in the workplace. Overall, 18.9% of Muslims aged between 16 and 74 are currently in full-time employment. That is significantly less than the 34.9% figure for the adult population of the UK overall. And I would just point out that although that's low, 34.9% for the adult population, don't forget that they are also including all the other non-whites in that. So 15%, I guess it is, that is of Britain is non-white. So it's likely to be, again, about 80 or 90% of them that are unemployed. So that will keep the figure down low. I mean, white people want to work. We don't want to be on the dole. It says, continuing with the article, it says, part of the reason for the low employment rate is that Muslim women are far more likely to stay at home and not look for work as they are mothers. 18% of adult Muslim women are recorded as looking after home and family, three times as many as in the population as a whole. Well, it's nice that they can afford to do that, isn't it? White women can't afford to do that. Our wages are now so low by bringing women into the workforce that a man can't actually make enough money to keep his wife there at home looking after the kids. They have to go out to work because wages are half as much as they should be. But somehow the Muslims are able to keep their women at home. Only 6% of Muslims are in managerial or professional jobs, compared to 10% of the British population. So again, that's half as much as it would be for the rest of the population. And the rest of the population, again, as I said before, it's not entirely white. We've still got non-whites in that as well. And yet it's still half as good as white people. The report claims young people from Islamic backgrounds believe they must work 10 times as hard to get the same opportunities as other workers. Well, that's very strange because I keep seeing job adverts saying that we are specifically looking for Muslims or black and ethnic minorities. So quite clearly they don't have to work 10 times as hard. They've got specific adverts aimed at them. It said Muslim job seekers felt they were less likely to get interviewed by employers if they had an ethnic sounding name, and women complained they faced discrimination if they wore a hijab at work, making them feel uncomfortable expressing their faith. Well, how about how uncomfortable they make their fellow workers feel when they can't see their face and when they know that they are wearing a political uniform, marking them out as being members of a political organization, a political Islam, because that's what the hijab is. And it also means that they aren't going to be raped. I've changed my view on this. I used to think, well, I don't really care whether they wear hijabs or not. But I'm thinking about this now. I mean, that shows that they are members of a political organisation. And in Britain, we're not allowed to wear uniforms if we're part of a political organisation. But somehow these Muslims get away with it because they're part of the religion of peace, I guess. Florian, I noticed you laughing at this.
Well, you're bang on with the symbology there. And it's not just traditionally speaking, women in any society, even European society, wearing a veil, it denotes exactly that you're a member of a household, which is the basic political unit of society. And so for Muslim women, That household is the Ummah, the tribe of the Prophet Muhammad, the community of all believers, which itself is constituted as a political entity in the basic, you know, fundamental tenets of Islam. European women, this used to be, they used to veil their heads once they got married to signify exactly, you know, the same thing. But you're right, is that the purpose is not, it comes back to this, you know, we have to reject the entire moral premises upon which these claims are based, that, you know, we should afford, people from foreign religions in our land equal exercise of their religious beliefs. I mean, to very begin with, they shouldn't be here, but, you know, if they are going to come here, certainly, the British Isles has a Christian history which goes back to, you know, 3 years after the crucifixion of Christ. So there's no pedigree or ability for them to make any sort of moral claim that we should ameliorate our societies to allow them to practice their religion freely. Not at all. You're right. I mean, the whole purpose of this kind of thing is to signal to the world their inclusion as part of, you know, the household of the Prophet Muhammad, of the Ummah of Islam. And that's all well and fine when they're in, you know, Arabia, but certainly not in the United Kingdom.
Well, they expect us to make exceptions for it. You know, all of those answers that they gave, saying, "Oh, we have to work 10 times as hard." They don't employ us because of our names. We feel uncomfortable wearing our hijabs. Every one of those is saying, "Oh, the British people have to make exceptions for us. They have to learn how to read Arabic so that they can pronounce our names correctly." It's so difficult. You see these names that come up, these new MPs or politicians or even just actors on the television, and you can't even pronounce their names because they're written in a completely foreign language. I mean, and we are expected to understand that language and pronounce their names correctly. It should be the other way around. They should, if they want to fit in, they should be writing their name so that it can be pronounced in English, not expecting us to make exceptions for them. All the time, we have to make these exceptions, and then we are told we are racist. Our countries are doing our best to make these exceptions for them in the first place. We are not racist. Our countries are not racist. We don't hate other people. If we hated other people, we never would have let them in the first place. We just want to prevent our own people being replaced by them, which is a perfectly natural way to feel. Well, we've got some positive polls here as well. This is an immigration poll in Britain. It says on the 25th and the 26th of April, YouGov asked 1,668 British adults, overall, do you think immigrants from each of the following parts of the world made a positive or negative contribution to life in Britain today? The most highly rated migrant groups were those often said to be well integrated or with strong cultural, geographic or historical ties to the UK. Funnily enough, they also happen to be white, namely Australians plus 45, Irish plus 40, Germans plus 38, Americans plus 36 and Polish migrants plus 28. Now, they have got some non-white ones in there, but they're all under 20. So half as well integrated as the white ones, if we think of Australians at 45. Those who rated more negatively were more recently arrived groups, or those often considered not very well integrated. They are Pakistanis, minus 2. Well, Pakis have been here since the Windrush, since sort of 50 years ago. So they can't say that they've only just arrived. Pakis, Bangladeshis, Nigerians, minus 11, and then it's got Romanians, minus 18. But what that really means is gypsies. They're talking about the Roma there, not the genuine Romanian people who are white people. And Somalis, minus 21. The same poll revealed that most people think immigration has been too high over the past 10 years, and that 71% of people back the government's hostile environment to illegal migrants after the so-called Windrush scandal. And the first thing this new Paki Home Secretary has said is that he's going to do away with the hostile environment to illegal immigrants, which is going completely against public opinion. The government have said about how terrible it is that these Windrush immigrants, they're illegal immigrants because they don't have papers. Some of them have been investigated for being sent back. But the British public, that's what we want. We want them sent back. And this poll proves that. It also gave an indication as to what voters want the UK's immigration system to look like after Brexit, when the UK takes back control of its borders. People were most supportive of bringing in National Health Service workers, plus 63, international students, plus 57, highly educated and or skilled workers, plus 53, and of course wealthy investors, plus 41. Less popular were refugees, plus 26, relatives of existing migrants, plus 4. Migrants with a low level of education and or skill were drastically, significantly less popular, with minus 26. And that includes these people that we are being told are refugees, and that there's a huge public outcry that we must open up our borders and let these people in. Well, that's just not true, because it's minus 26. The migrants with a low level of educational skill is the least popular group of all, with minus 26. So although this isn't a fantastic poll, it's still showing that public opinion is behind what nationalists are saying. Whether they approve of nationalists or not, what we are saying is in tune with public opinion, and what the government are saying is the complete opposite of public opinion.
Yeah, I mean, indeed. And I mean, this the greatest thing, I mean, certainly in Canada and the United States, is that people are extremely reticent to admit anti, you know, immigrant sentiment, even to anonymous pollers, because there is such a strong social control through political correctness. And it's, I mean, all of us have certainly had an experience. If you come from these countries, if you discuss this issue or one related to these people, you know, if somebody is even centrist or mildly liberal, that they're, you can watch the terror begin to creep over their face and their countenance as you kind of go into the wrong thing territory, even among, you know, kind of conservatives and in those sort of circles. You know, you're going to be the edgiest person, you know, at the party, and, you know, kind of be breaking through the ice of what everyone wants to say if you bring up, you know, maybe we should preserve our culture from total destruction by limiting mass migration. And so I think that the critical thing, as we always come back to, is that, you know, it's the only way that you can express the fullness of sanity is by totally changing the moral framing and the moral window in which people evaluate these issues, because people have become so conditioned by the mass culture, by mass media, the destruction of traditional and corruption of traditional religion and so on, that, you know, they have twisted their moral conception, where they view it as, you know, a high act of Christian decency and charity to admit, you know, some so-called refugee from the Sudan, right? Quite laughably. And so, you know, rather than arguing with people based on, you know, these liberal premises, we need to try and break people out of this entire frame of thinking. I mean, frankly, you know, it's kind of a conversion away from that whole moral paradigm, because it's this control of that, you know, liberal conservative dialectic that the mainstream has, mainstream liberalism has enabled, has fashioned as a prop for itself, that it's given itself this inertia, because people's, you know, natural resentment and, you know, issues are channeled in one direction or another, you know, the kind of swinging pendulum, while never going outside of the accepted bounds of discourse. And no system in the world in its history has exemplified this false dialectic more than the United Kingdom and its parliamentary politics.
Well, those questions that were actually asked in the poll, we know that they will be loaded. And of course, people, you know, are worried to actually speak the truth. And yet still 70% of them said, went directly against what the government are saying about Windrush, and said, well, no, we want a hostile environment against these illegal immigrants. Well, I've got a final poll here, and this is a Twitter poll, and this is from the author of Titanic Britain, which is a book written about what the left has done to Britain. So I guess you could say that, you know, it mainly would have been conservative people that responded to this poll, but he still managed to get 2,246 votes, which is a sizable number. And the question he asked is, what form of terrorism most terrifies you in Britain? 4% said far-right terrorism. 1% said the IRA. 2% said flat earth terrorism. I guess that must have been a bit of a jokey one he put in there. And 93% said Islamic jihadi terrorism, which is the opposite, again, of what you would think from reading the newspapers. If you were reading the newspapers, you would think that far-right terrorism was at least as equal to Islamic jihadi terrorism. But it's not, according to this poll. It's less than 5% of the amount of people that think that Islamic jihadi terrorism is the main threat that we have to worry about in Britain. So again, that is quite encouraging. It just shows you how separate the government's thinking is and the establishment's thinking is from the general man on the street. The general man on the street thinks like a nationalist, because being a nationalist is completely natural. It's the central position. It's the centre ground. It's what conforms to natural order and the right way to be. It's morally right to be a nationalist. And the people support us. It's just that they don't know that their own thoughts and their own ideas about things have now been classified as far right. You know, you talk to people, older people don't realize that they now come under the heading of far right in Britain. They are wondering what's going on, because they know that all the people around them still think the same way that they do, but they're absolutely shocked to see what's going on in the government. Absolutely shocked to see that there's a Pakistani in charge of our borders now and in charge of immigration, that there's a Muslim that's the mayor of London. All of these things the British public find absolutely horrific, but at the same time they still need to go that little bit further and start supporting those of us on the far right who are speaking about these things. That's the main difference that really needs working on, is getting the public to realize that their normal center ground views are what the far right are talking about. And of course that's why the mainstream media tries to shut us down and prevent us from actually talking about our views. Florian, I don't know if you want to add anything on this poll before we finish this Twitter poll.
No, I would merely say that there are not very many far-right dudes that are driving trucks into crowds of people in Europe. So less than you'd expect, frankly.
Well, they try to make it up, don't they? Like James Fields in Charlottesville, quite obviously an accident, yet that's being portrayed as right-wing, pro-white terrorism. I really do hope and pray that he gets a fair trial. Anyway, thank you very much for coming on today, Florian. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back on Monday with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.